Talk Show. Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here with Pastor William Fink in our ongoing series on the book of Acts. I hope you've all been enjoying our series on the book of Daniel. And we have been talking about all the magnificent prophecies that are occurring in that book. Of course, the book of Acts is more of a history book of the times after the crucifixion and the various Christian sects that were arising and the attempts by Paul to explain the effect of the crucifixion and the sacrifice that Yahshua Messiah made on the cross and how it affects all of Israel, including the dispersed Israelites, not just the Judahites. In fact, there was great disputation among those Judahites who we have been referring to as the traditionalists, which must be distinguished from the Jews, who are Edomites and Canaanites and have no commonality with the Judahites and or Israelites of the Bible. Okay, so last time we left off at Acts 23, verse 21. Bill, do you want to bring us up to date before we continue reading here?
Yeah, I think the most important thing we illuminated last week was the account in Acts 22:9, where when it's read properly, Acts 22:9 has, and Paul's account of his road to Damascus event has absolutely no conflict with the version he gives in Acts chapter 9, where it says, and they who were with me surely beheld the light, but for the voice they did not understand that being spoken to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives that account during an address to, generally, the people, the Judeans in Jerusalem, an address he gives in Hebrew after he's seized and falsely accused by the Judeans from Asia.
Right.
That probably those ones that gave him a hard time in Thessalonia.
Right, right.
And he's seized by them, and he basically ends up in the Roman clink.
Right.
And where we are now in Acts 23 is that Paul has a nephew, which makes it evident that Paul had close family in Jerusalem.
Right, right.
At least a sister and her son,
uh-huh,
who are mentioned. And you know, they're never mentioned because biblical characters are only mentioned on a need-to-know basis, basically.
Right.
Well, Paul's nephew goes to the commander of the Roman legion in Jerusalem and explains to him that the Judeans have a plot against him and they're seeking to kill him.
Right.
And Paul and his nephew explain this to this commander.
Well, okay, let me back up to verse 21 where he says that to the jailer here. But do not you yield to them, for they lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him, that is, killed Paul. And now are they ready, looking for a promise from you. Okay, so continuing with verse 22. So the chief captain then let the young man depart and charged him, see you, tell no man that you have showed these things to me. So this young man was making the jailer aware of these things. And he called to him two centurions, saying, make ready 200 soldiers to go to Caesarea, and horsemen 70, and spearmen 200 at the third hour of the night, and provide them beasts that they may set Paul on, and bring him safe to Felix the governor. Okay, any comment up to this point here?
Well, that's quite a cadre.
Yes.
You know, that's no joke. The commander gave this account a lot of credence.
Yes.
And took this threat very seriously.
Right, right. Yeah, you're talking horsemen, spearmen.
You're talking about a whole, I mean, it's not a legion.
Uh-huh.
A Roman legion typically had 5,000 men, but it's a pretty good chunk. It's a pretty good squad of soldiers.
Right, right.
200, making 200 guys walk to Caesarea.
Yes, yeah.
Because the cavalry, that means the 200 are walking.
Yes. Now, at the third hour of the night, because my understanding of the scriptures is that the day was divided into 12 hours, the daytime period, and the nighttime was divided into watches.
Four watches, yes.
Yes. And so at the third hour of the night, what time would this be now?
Well, the third watch of the night would probably be between 2 and 4 a.m.
Okay, so be very early morning before the sun came up.
Okay. Right, and the last watch would be from 4 to 6.
From 4 to 6, okay. So verse 25, and he wrote a letter after this manner, Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix sends greeting. This man was taken of the Judeans and should have been killed of them. Then came I with an army and rescued him, having understood that he was a Roman. And when I would have known the cause whereof they accused him, I brought him forth unto their council, whom I perceived to be accused of questions of their law, but to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds. Okay, so very similar to Pilate and Messiah, right?
Right, exactly. And I'm sorry, I screwed the watches up. The third watch would be from midnight to 3.
Midnight to 3?
We're talking a 12-hour night, not an 8-hour night.
A 12-hour, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it varied. It varied at different times.
Well, yeah, but it was roughly estimated from midnight to 3.
Okay.
They didn't. I imagine they had some sort of device to keep track of the watches.
Okay.
Because
yeah.
they always knew what watch of the night it was. I mean, that they wrote it with confidence, not only in the Bible, but in the history books too.
Right, right.
Around the second watch of the night, around the third watch. They knew with confidence. And mm-hmm. Either they kept darn good track of the moon and the stars, but the moon's not always out.
Right. That's right, yeah.
And it's not always out at night when it is out.
Uh-huh.
Okay. It's, you know, sometimes it's below the horizon. You can't see it. The course of the moon isn't as precise as the course of the sun.
Right. It's possible that they told time by the motion of the constellations. They probably had people who knew what part of the constellation at what point
They definitely told the seasons by the motion of the constellations.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know about the hours.
Yeah, yeah. But they obviously did have some way of doing it, you know. Maybe
yeah.
they just had somebody counting.
Right. And they may have really had a
clock of some kind.
Well, yeah, they found devices at the bottom of the sea.
Were
complex Swiss clock-like objects.
Right.
That they found even recently in the bottom of the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
That had 20, 30 gears in them.
Right.
And kept track of all sorts of things. That they imagined these things were pretty accurate timepieces.
Yeah, they were parlor toys. Yeah, absolutely. They had more technology than we give them credit for. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, absolutely. But
yeah.
They just didn't. Yeah, you know, you pick up an American, a modern book in English and read through it, and it doesn't describe all of our technology to a T, unless it's like a Tom Clancy book.
Right.
But I mean, your average pulp novel doesn't.
Right. Of course not. Of course not. Yeah, and then the Parthians, they actually had batteries. And a lot of people don't understand that the Dark Ages, which were precipitated by the Catholic Church, really, it eliminated a lot of technical and scientific knowledge that used to exist and basically turned the world into an ignorant mass of peasants.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I agree. The Greeks were very advanced.
Yeah.
Archimedes, you know, some of the descriptions of Diodorus and other writers about some of the inventions of Archimedes were
yeah.
amazing.
The feudal system really, and that's why it's called the Dark Ages.
Well, it was a good economic system for us compared to Jewish capitalism
right.
or Jewish communism.
Right. Well, it was Catholic communism.
But it was not a time for invention and innovation.
Absolutely not. It was a historical low. And we can go historically backwards and historically forwards, and we find that the rule of the Catholic Church was really the lowest point ever for science and know-how. Yes, absolutely.
Well, that's probably true, but the Enlightenment really didn't do us any favors.
No.
When the Catholic Church approved the taking of interest and
right.
Yeah, you know, right. It's trading one evil for another isn't good either.
Fausto says that 2,000 years ago there were already soft drink machines.
Yeah. They took shekels, I'm sure.
They were leather bags, right?
I'm sure they wouldn't take a Roman quadrant. You
right.
had to have a shekel.
Yeah, what coins would they take? Right, exactly. Okay, verse 30.
Well, let me say real quick that,
okay.
you know, that this letter of Claudius to Governor Felix was, you know, he says that concerning inquiries of their law,
mm-hmm.
and the Romans would have been basically ignorant of their law.
Of course.
Yeah, you know, and that's how he couldn't judge the matter.
Right.
I just wanted to mention that.
But he knew that Paul was a Roman citizen and therefore had to be protected.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, verse 30 then. And when it was told me how that the Judeans, or in this case Jews is probably the proper translation because we're talking about Edomite Jews, laid wait for the man, I sent immediately to you and gave commandment to his accusers also to say before you what they had against him. Farewell. Then the soldiers, as it was commanded to them, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. On the morrow they left the horsemen to go with him and returned to the castle, who, when they came to Caesarea and delivered the epistle to the governor, presented Paul also before him. And when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was, and when he understood that he was of Cilicia, I will hear you, he said, when your accusers are also come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. Okay. So
I'm going to pick on your pronunciation for a change, since you're always picking on mine.
Yeah, right.
All Greek K's were hard.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I know that.
And,
yeah.
And all Roman C's were actually hard.
Yes.
The Roman C was always hard. It was the medieval church that softened up the C.
Right, and it's really the Boston Celtics, not the Boston Celtics.
Yes. Yes. It's Cilicia.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, well, this is the anglicized pronunciation. Excuse me.
I have to get even worse.
Right. Right, I know. I'm always doing that to you.
The words I'm butchering.
Yeah. Chapter 24, verse 1. And after 5 days, Ananias, the high priest, descended with the elders and with a certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. Okay, so an orator, a professional orator. Okay. And when he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, see that by you we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done to this nation by your providence. Okay, so in other words, disturbing the peace, which is what the Jews are always accusing us of, because we're disturbing their New World Order by exposing it. Verse 3,
first, notice how this orator that the Judeans hired,
yeah,
the first thing he does is play the sycophant.
Play the what?
The sycophant. He kisses his rear, his derriere.
Right. He's a butt kisser. Yeah.
Right off the bat. You know, he talks about how having obtained much peace on account of you and reforms coming
right
to this nation by your foresight.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah.
If somebody immediately kisses your butt, you know they're trying to get something out of you.
Exactly.
That they're not worthy of.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Get to the point. What do you want? Okay. Quit trying to butter me up. Yeah. And if anybody falls for that, he's stupid. Right.
Well, people fall for it all the time.
Right.
Look at Obama.
Exactly. Verse 3. We accept it always in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Okay, we love you so much. Verse 4, notwithstanding that I be not further tedious to you.
But in order that I do not hinder you.
Yeah, okay. I pray you that you would hear us of your clemency a few words, of your kindness, right? For we have found this man a pestilent fellow and a mover of sedition. Not the mother of sedition. Among all the Jews throughout the world, and all the Judeans, of course, he's speaking for all the Judeans, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes.
Now let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Nazarenes, or it's actually Nazorians.
Okay.
There are actually two different Greek words, which are both said by Strong to mean of Nazareth.
Okay.
And the one is Nazarenus, and that's the more natural way to say that in Greek.
Right.
And the other one is Nazarius, and that's the word that appears here.
Okay.
And the King James often translates either word the same. You know, they really don't
right
distinguish between them.
Is there a difference in Greek?
Well, not really, but it seems that Nazarenus is used more of the geography, and Nazorian is
right.
The Greek word is used more of the sect.
Yes.
Now, first let me say that Josephus writes and mentions this sect, you know, writing in a period about this same time.
Yeah, the Nazarites.
The
yes
sixth decade or the seventh decade A.D., you know,
okay,
the 50s and 60s A.D. Now, let me say that the Judeans would not use the word Christian.
Right.
Because using the word Christ, they call them the Nazarene, basically.
Yeah.
Because using the word, just using the word Christ, they would be admitting that he's the Messiah.
That's right.
And we don't understand that in English, that just by using certain words, we're making the admission, and that's how we always lose the culture battle.
Right, yeah. Well, just like
you know
today,
I mean?
We call ourselves Israelites because we are.
Well, right, but a lot of times we'll use words like gay and
right.
homosexual and words
bag,
and
yeah.
coin
right.
in order to normalize a deviancy.
Yes.
And we go along with it and use it, and that makes the deviancy normal.
Right.
Yeah, you
right.
know, just using the term. So the Judeans would not use the term Christ or Christian because it would admit that he was who he was.
Right. Yeah. So in essence, the word Nazarene simply is a reference to the town he was from. And a little more than that, but isn't there
and
also...
it was, you know, I'm sure that Yahweh had all this planned out years before because
right.
the sect of the Nazarenes was dead.
Okay.
And a lot of even people in identity try to revive the sect of the Nazarenes.
Yes.
Like they wouldn't cut their hair or their nails.
Right.
In order to claim a special form of ritualistic righteousness.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, that's the way I see that. But the sect of the Nazarenes by the time of Christ was dead.
Okay.
The apostles all drank wine. There's no doubt.
Uh-huh.
And, however, he was called a Nazarene after the town of Nazareth, but it also fulfilled the prophecy that he would be called a Nazarene.
Right, right. And, yeah, there was a sect called the Nazarites who were, as I understand it, the word actually means pure white, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't know about that, but the word Nazarite in the Old Testament, it's first mentioned in Numbers chapter 6.
Okay.
And it also appears in Judges 13 and
yeah.
16 and Lamentations 4. So they were around for a while.
But they were Judahites and or Benjamites who lived in the town of Nazareth or congregated there at least. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, no, they were. It was actually the town does not seem to exist at all.
Oh. Okay.
In the Old Testament.
In the Old Testament. Okay.
Right. It was the Nazarite is first mentioned in Numbers chapter 6, and it's simply some sort of
it's a sect.
Special priesthood
uh-huh.
that was set up.
Okay.
And Samson was the first notable Nazarite, I believe.
Okay. All right.
And that's why he never cut his hair.
Right, right. And the special diet and all that stuff. Right. Okay.
Right. And what I'm going to say one more thing. Josephus mentioning Nazorians or Nazarites at the time that he did
uh-huh.
is simply a further confirmation of the historicity of the gospel.
Right. Very good. No, no doubt about that. Yes, very good. Okay, verse 6. Who also has gone about to profane the temple. Of course, no Roman would really be caring about that. Whom we took, unless, the temple in Caesarea was actually built by Herod for pagan gods, probably many Roman gods as well, I would expect. And would have judged according to our law. But he does refer back to Judean law. Verse 7.
Well, to profane the temple means to make it common.
Right.
Which means to bring in uncircumcised people.
Okay.
And that's what they accused him of.
Okay. Well, yeah, the Roman prelate here wouldn't really care about that. You know, I'm sure he would
think. Well, right, but they knew it was a law and they had plaques all around the temple.
Right.
But that's the most serious thing they could imagine confusing him of. And Paul refutes that effectively in the next chapter,
yeah.
in the next paragraph.
Yeah. Okay, so verse 7 then. But the chief captain Lysias came upon us and with great violence took him away out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come to you by examining of whom yourself may take knowledge of all these things, whereof we accuse him. So this is his opening statement here. Okay, verse 9. And the Jews also assented, saying that these things were so. Of course they agreed. Then Paul, after that the governor had beckoned to him to speak, answered, for as much as I know that you have been of many years a judge to this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because that you may understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem for to worship. And they neither found me in the temple disputing with any man, neither raising up the people, neither in the synagogues nor in the city, neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me. But
let me say that Paul is basically using a hearsay defense.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, he was in the temple. They seized him in the temple.
Right.
If he was with anybody that didn't belong in the temple, they'd have seized that person too.
Right.
Because we've seen from the archaeology, and I have it posted on my site, that an uncircumcised or a Gentile coming into the temple is under penalty of death.
That's right.
However, Paul's saying, look, they didn't catch me with anybody.
Right.
And they can't prove the things that they can. He's saying that it's just a false accusation. It's
yes, yes. And he wasn't arguing with anybody either, okay?
Well,
he
right.
Stirring
if
up the people.
Actually, if he'd actually been caught with a Greek in the temple, they'd have had the Greek.
Yeah.
You know, they'd have had the Greek, and Paul would have been, you know, it would have been evident right there.
Yeah, well, they were basically accusing him of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, really?
Because we today, if we criticize the Jews, if they could make it a law, they would make it a law. They're trying to make it a law. It's called hate legislation, right?
Right.
They're trying to do that to us right now.
Absolutely. It's going
to
fail.
Yes. Verse 14, but this I confess to you, that after the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets. Okay. So they say, well, I obey the law. These people don't.
And well, right. And he's basically, it boils down to a matter that they're just accusing him falsely, but the Romans don't quite, they aren't going to buy it that way.
Well, sure, sure. So let's see what else he has to say here. And have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. Okay, so he's talking about the Pharisees here.
And that word heresy is actually a sect. It's not a heresy.
Oh, really?
The word is heresis. It's the Greek word heresis is transliterated in the Bible to heresy.
Uh-huh.
But a heresis in Greek is a sect.
A sect.
It's a common word that means a sect.
So let me read that again, verse 14. But this I confess to you, that after the way which they call a sect,
right.
So worship I the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets. Okay, he was the true sect, the sect of
well, right,
truth.
Absolutely,
yes. Yes, and have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. And of course, Paul states this explicitly in his epistles, verse 16. And herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men. Yes, and that's what he counseled us constantly to do is, you know, don't make unnecessary trouble, certainly not with Yahweh, and certainly not with men if you can avoid it. You know, always have good intentions toward men. Verse 17, now after many years I came to bring alms to my nation and offerings, whereupon certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult. What's he saying here?
Well, they found him being purified in the temple, not with a crowd nor with a tumult. He's repeating his argument from before.
Right, okay.
That so. They, you know, he was acting peaceably in the temple and going about one of the common rituals, and they just seized on him.
Right,
no
okay.
Reason.
Are we referring back to the head shaving?
No, it's the purification ritual in the temple. I think that's done after the head shaving.
Oh, okay. All right. So verse 19, who ought to have been here before you and object if they had anything against me? Okay, so basically he's still saying that their charges are baseless, verse 20. Or else let these same here say, if they have found any evil doing in me while I stood before the council, except it be for this one voice that I cried standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called into question by you this day. So he's telling Felix, you know, this is a doctrinal dispute, okay, between myself and these Pharisees. Verse 22, and when Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way, he deferred them and said, when Lysias the chief captain shall come down, I will know the uttermost of your matter. So is Felix now prepared to judge a matter of Judean doctrine, do you think, here?
Well, he really can't.
He can't, no.
No, he really can't, and it's going to end up in a stalemate, and Paul's going to end up staying in the clink.
Right, right.
And
okay.
That's it. He's not getting out of custody because of a stalemate. The
yes.
Romans, you know, they really don't know what to do with him. Right. And he would only anger the Judeans against him, which we're going to see got him in trouble anyway.
Right.
They would only anger the Judeans against him if he just let Paul go.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So again,
and he didn't want to do that.
Again, Felix is in the same position that Pilate was, yes. Verse 23, and he commanded a centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty, and that he should forbid none of his acquaintance to minister or to come to him. By liberty, we don't mean he was let loose, but that...
Well, he was in custody, but he wasn't chained or put in a cell or anything.
And he was allowed to have visitors, etc. Yeah.
He basically probably stayed on the proconsul's estate in Caesarea.
So it was protective custody, house arrest, as it were. Verse 24...
Right.
And after certain days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, which was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ.
Now I'd like to make a few comments here.
Okay.
First, this Felix was the proconsul or the procurator in Judea for a long time.
Okay.
From 52 to 59 A.D.
All right.
And the term of office is only 2 years. And typically, they switched around, these proconsuls.
Okay.
They would stay in one place for 2 years, and they'd get shipped somewhere else.
Okay.
It was actually the Roman Senate that chose the proconsuls for the provinces.
Okay.
Okay.
The major office, yeah.
Right. Every other year, the Roman Senate chose the proconsuls, and men would jockey for their favorite for their favorite districts.
Right.
And it's highly unusual, I think, in Roman history for one guy to stay in the same province for three, four terms in a row.
That's because nobody else wanted it.
Well, right. Maybe nobody else wanted the job, but he was married to a Judean.
So
maybe, he did want the job, and since nobody else did.
So he got himself fixed up, and now he has to live with it.
Right. Now, he was relieved, and it seemed – now, I have to apologize because a few weeks ago I thought this happened to Pontius Pilate, and it didn't. You know, I had my Roman offices screwed up.
Okay.
But it seems that Felix did a lot of favors to the Judeans, and they ended up causing him trouble elsewhere.
Right.
Because upon Felix's – now, this is recorded now by Josephus in his Antiquities.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Upon Felix's being relieved of the of this office by Festus,
okay,
he went to Rome to stand before the Emperor Nero. The Syrians of Caesarea were always competing with the Judeans for control of the city.
Okay.
Okay? For political control.
Right.
And the Syrians had bribed a man close to Nero so that man would make an accusation against Felix.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Okay.
And Felix really only withstood the accusation due to the intercession of a prominent brother named Pallas.
Okay.
Who was prominent. His brother was prominent in Roman politics.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise,
yeah.
Felix would have probably lost his head.
Would have been convicted,
but,
yeah.
But yeah, doing all his kissing up to the Judeans, actually the Syrians.
Right. Yeah. That just shows how both Felix and Pontius Pilate were in big trouble. You get caught in the middle of these regional disputes, it could cost your life.
Right.
And Pontius Pilate was in exactly the same position. Yes.
Right. Now we know from Roman records that it's evident in Josephus's history that Felix was held this office until 59 A.D.
Okay.
So from verse 27 here, we know that Paul's captivity began in 57.
Okay. Well, let me read these last three verses in chapter 24 and bring us up to verse 27. And as he reasoned of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, Felix trembled and answered, "Go your way for this time. When I have a convenient season, I will call for you." He hoped also that money should have been given him of Paul, that he might loose him. Wherefore he sent for him the oftener. What's the oftener?
More often.
Oh, okay. The off. Sent for him more often and communed with him. But after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's room, and Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul bound. So, in other words, he just left him under house arrest, okay?
That's actually Porcius.
Porcius, right.
It's like infested pork. It's
right.
What a name some of these Romans had.
Yeah, right. Okay, chapter 25, verse 1. Now, when Festus was come into the province, after 3 days he ascended from Caesarea, to Jerusalem. And then the high priest and the chief of the Jews informed him against Paul and besought him and desired favor against him that he would send for him to Jerusalem, laying wait in the way to kill him. And again, Paul is always in trouble. He's always in legal trouble and in fear of his own life because people
are always saying, never did anything to anybody.
That's right. He was just preaching the gospel, right? And even his own people hated him for preaching.
Well, right. And this, you know, the Paul bashers are, I got to mention it again, they're just fools.
Okay, yeah.
But, you know, if Paul is opposed by all of these Edomite Judeans,
yes,
then he must have been doing the right thing.
He must have been doing something right.
Bottom
yes.
line.
Yes.
And if Paul was a phony and made all this up, well, then, this would have been a very rosy account of everything Paul did.
Right, right. Well, right. I mean, these are historical
and
figures.
And troublemakers accusing Paul of changing his name, and that's a pretty foolish accusation. I challenge him to show me where Paul changed his name, because that's a dumb statement.
Well, Saul / Paul.
No. Paul did not change his name.
Right. Yeah, it wasn't him. It's the same name in different languages.
Well, no, it wasn't even the same name in different languages.
Okay.
It was that Paul had, like every other Roman, multiple names.
Okay.
And for some reason, Luke, the scribe, decided to start using Paul's other name.
Okay.
And Saul was his common given name. Paulus right. was his family name.
Okay. So Saul,
okay.
Paul.
And Troublemaker doesn't know what he's talking about.
Okay, Troublemaker. All right.
Well,
so,
I know he's a Paul basher,
I know.
So he's going to get it from me once
right.
in a while.
Okay. All right, let's continue here. Verse 4, but Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself would depart shortly from there. Let them, therefore, said he, which among you are able, go down with me and accuse this man, if there be any wickedness in him. And when he had tarried among them more than 10 days, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, commanded Paul to be brought. And when he was come, the Jews which came down from Jerusalem stood round about and laid many and grievous complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. While he answered for himself, neither against the laws of the Judahites, neither against the temple, nor yet against Caesar, have I offended anything at all. But Festus, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul and said, will you go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me? Okay, seems like a fair enough proposition. Then said Paul, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. To the Jews have I done no wrong, as you very well know. For if I be an offender or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if there be none of these things whereof these accuse me, no man may deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar. Okay? So, fortunately, Paul was a Roman citizen and was able to appeal to Caesar.
Well, right. And the Holy Spirit told him he was going to Rome, and this was how he got there.
Right. Okay.
You know, that there was no other way for him to go to Rome.
Right.
The Jews wanted to kill him.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Anybody that doesn't like Paul must be a Jew. and wants to kill him again.
Right.
But the Jews wanted to kill him.
Yes.
And the Romans didn't know what to do with him.
Right.
So if he did not have the appeal to Caesar, if he was not a Roman citizen, then it's basically the Romans have to turn him over to the judgment of the ethnic authorities.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Just like they did to Christ. Pilate
right.
had no choice.
Exactly.
Christ had no appeal to Caesar.
Yes. Because he was not a Roman citizen.
Right.
Yes.
And the apostles, most of them were not Roman citizens. They were the natives of Galilee, they were not born Roman citizens. And it's just a political designation.
Yeah.
Where Cilicia, the province of Cilicia, was recognized as belonging to the people, you know, to the Roman people. And it was basically populated by Greeks at that time anyway.
Uh-huh, yes.
And that would have, you know, the Romans recognized the Kilikians as citizens in their governmental structure,
right.
But the Judeans did not have that recognition.
Right, and Paul identifies himself in at least two places as a descendant of the tribe of Benjamin. So it's clear that he is of the house of Judah and therefore an Israelite and fully justified in calling himself an Israelite. Okay, but also a Roman citizen, which probably not too many Israelites were able to say, or those who understood who they were, okay? But there are probably more in Tarsus who were in that situation, but certainly not in Paul's circumstances, okay? Verse 12, then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered, have you appealed to Caesar? To Caesar shall you go. And after certain days, King Agrippa and Bernice came up to Caesarea to salute Festus, and when they had been there many days, Festus declared Paul's cause to the king, saying, there is a certain man left in bonds by Felix, about whom, when I was yet at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me, desiring to have judgment against him.
Now let me say a couple of things. When Paul appeals to Caesar, that relieves Festus of having to deal with the Jews.
Right.
Because they're nagging him.
Yes.
Because they want Paul.
Mm-hmm.
So when Paul appeals to Caesar, he's happy.
That's right.
I see that as a happy statement. You have appealed to Caesar. Right. You're off my hands. You're out of my hair.
Yeah, like that judge in California who's going to hear Obama's birth certificate case.
Yeah, right.
We'll see how he handles that.
Yeah, right. What is he, a municipal judge? Is he going to issue a traffic ticket?
He's a federal judge, former Marine, so maybe he's got guts. I don't know.
not if he likes his pension and his paycheck.
That's right.
I'd like to talk about Agrippus.
Okay.
This King Agrippus, this is actually Herod Agrippa II.
Okay.
The son of Herod Agrippa, who was the one that died in Acts chapter 12.
Okay.
Okay. He was made king by the Romans over Chalcis. Now, there's two cities called Chalcis. One's in Greece. He's not a king in Greece.
Right.
There's a city called Chalcis in Syria at this time.
Okay.
And he's given that kingdom, but Galilee was added to that kingdom for him, and that happened under the Emperor Claudius.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Now, Berenice is his sister.
Uh-huh.
Okay? His older sister. And he, Herod Agrippa came to his uncle's kingdom. His uncle's name was Herod also.
Okay.
It's very confusing.
Right.
His father's Herod Agrippa I, and his uncle's also named Herod, and I don't know his given name. Okay?
Okay.
Now there were 10 Herods mentioned in Josephus.
Okay.
Now, Bernice is this Herod Agrippa's sister. However, she was married to her uncle.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
The Herod family, the Edomites are famous for this. They just love marrying their nieces and their nephews.
Right, right.
Okay?
The Rothschilds still do it today.
now, when this Herod Agrippa came to his uncle's throne, he basically inherited his uncle's kingdom and his uncle's wife. He got his sister back, basically.
Right.
off his dirty old uncle.
Right.
is what happened.
Okay. Okay.
And Josephus mentions this pair quite often.
Right, yeah. No, it's recorded history that the Jews always try to keep it in their family, the reins of power, keep it close to home. Yeah, yeah. Unless they can marry a white woman who's well-connected to, some major steel magnate who's not Jewish, or to royalty that's not Jewish, you know, that's when they'll marry outside of their family, okay? Verse 16, to whom I answered, it is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die before that he which is accused have the accusers face to face and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. So they had a very good system of justice where you allowed to face your accuser. And, you can go head-to-head with them. Verse 17, therefore, when they were come here without any delay on the morrow, I sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought forth, against whom when the accuser stood up, they brought no accusation of such things as I supposed, but had certain questions against him of their own superstition, of course meaning their religion, and of one Jesus, which was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. Okay. Well, okay, so this is his description. How did he get the idea that Paul is saying that Jesus Christ is alive, certainly not in the flesh?
I don't, it's basically Paul told him that he was arrested over the resurrection of the dead.
Okay.
Because the high priest and the leading priest at this time,
okay,
are Sadducees.
Okay.
And they don't believe in the resurrection.
Right. So he's talking about the resurrection here. Okay, verse 20. And because I doubted of such manner of questions, I asked him whether he would go to Jerusalem and there be judged of these matters. But when Paul had appealed to be reserved to the hearing of Augustus, I commanded him to be kept till I might send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I would also hear the man myself. Tomorrow, said he, you shall hear him. And on the morrow, when Agrippa was come, and Bernice, with
well,
great...
Well, let me...
Okay.
Did we... No, I don't think we got to it. Yeah.
Okay, so Agrippa
noted,
is now going to inquisit Paul.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, okay, it's the next paragraph. I'm sorry. I'm
okay.
Confused.
Now, let me continue here.
Yeah,
then.
Right. Agrippa really is out of the matter now, though.
Oh,
he wants
is?
To hear him.
Okay, so, yeah, so he just, out of his own curiosity, wants to...
Yeah, right, out of his own curiosity.
Yes, okay. And on the morrow, when Agrippa was come, and Bernice, with great pomp, and was entered into the place of hearing with the chief captains and principal men of the city, at Festus' commandment, Paul was brought forth. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all the men which are here present with us, you see this man about whom all the multitude of the Jews have dealt with me, both at Jerusalem and also here, crying that he ought not to live any longer. But when I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and that he himself has appealed to Augustus, I have determined to send him, of whom I have no certain thing to write to my Lord, whether
now, Paul,
I have...
Let's stop right there.
All right.
Why? Who is he addressing as my Lord? Because this is an instance of that word kurios being used as an adjective.
Okay.
And what he's saying is concerning which I do not have anything certain to write with authority.
Yes.
In other words, he has no charge against Paul.
Right.
That's what he's saying. But every time the King James translators saw that word kurios, they insisted on translating it Lord.
Okay.
And there's a whole there's probably about a dozen times where it should have been written with authority or is authority, and it's used as an adjective.
Right.
I just wanted to point that out right
yeah,
away.
Yeah, so in verse 26, it sounds like he's saying my Lord to Agrippa.
Well, right, and actually, the Roman proconsuls did not answer to these petty kings that they set up.
Right.
The petty king was in charge of tax farming, and they were really more like an ethnarch.
Right, right.
They had no real. They couldn't declare war.
Yeah.
They couldn't go to war. They couldn't defend themselves. They were basically no different than the governor of one of our states.
Right. Yeah.
And probably didn't even have that much authority in a lot of cases.
Right. Right. Yeah. So we can see here these Jews probably became proficient at tax collecting. For the Caesars, okay, for the Romans, and they were more than happy to collect taxes from true Israelites, because they knew they were oppressing true Israelites in that way, as they are doing today. Who's running the IRS? It's Jews.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So let me continue verse 26. Of whom I have no certain thing to write to my Lord, wherefore I have brought him forth before you, and especially before you, O King Agrippa, that after examination had, I might have somewhat to write. So he's utilizing this examination to see if there's any formal charge he can bring against Paul. Verse 27, for it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner, not withal to signify the crimes laid against him. Right. He's going to send him to Augustus Caesar.
And he has to have a letter explaining what he did.
Yeah, he has nothing to accuse him of.
Right.
Yeah, except that he disagrees about religious doctrine with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. That's it. Okay, chapter 26, verse 1. Then Agrippa said to Paul, you are permitted to speak for yourself. Then Paul stretched forth the hand and answered for himself, I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because I shall answer for myself this day before you, touching all the things whereof I am accused of the Jews, especially because I know you to be expert in all customs and questions which are among the Jews. Wherefore, I beseech you to hear me patiently. My manner of life from my youth, which was at the first among my own nation at Jerusalem, know all the Jews, which knew me from the beginning, if they would testify that after the most strict sect of your religion, I lived a Pharisee. Okay.
Now, why would he say among my own nation and in Jerusalem?
Right, yeah.
He recognizes, without really saying it explicitly, that I believe that that's a recognition of the multi-ethnic culture.
Okay.
That's my interjection. I mean, I can't prove that he's recognizing that, but
yes.
There's a few places Paul speaks that it sure as hell sounds like it.
Right. Okay, yeah, that's plausible. Let me read verse 4 again. My manner of life from my youth, which was at the first among my own nation at Jerusalem, okay, because there were people of other nations living in Jerusalem, especially the Edomites, know all the Judeans, which knew me from the beginning, if they would testify that after the most strict sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. And, of course, by the time of Paul, the Pharisees had intruded into the religion of the Judahites to a very great extent. And that's when the term Judaism most properly applies, because they started changing the religion of Moses by their own traditions. Okay, verse 6. And now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made of God to our fathers, to which promise our 12 tribes, instantly serving God day and night, hope to come. For which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews. Okay, so he's making a distinction between our 12 tribes and the Jews. So
absolutely.
I think your insight on verse 4 is correct.
Absolutely.
Verse 8, why should it be thought a thing incredible with you that God should raise the dead? I verily thought it with myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth, bringing up that horrible name, which thing I also did in Jerusalem, and many of the saints did I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests, and when they were put to death, I gave my voice against them. So again,
now this is saying, and upon their being slain, I had cast a vote.
Yes.
Is what it says.
I had cast a vote. Okay. And obviously a vote in favor.
Well, right. But what I'm trying to say is that there were definitely show trials.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Whenever you see the show trials, you see the Edomites.
Right. Exactly.
There's no doubt. And,
yeah.
And there were probably some Adamic Soviets on some of those juries.
Yes.
That were just going along with the Marxist crowd.
Yes. Yes. Yeah,
just like there was some Adamites at Nuremberg, just going along with the Jews.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Well, their favorite tactic is to hire Adamites to be their spokesman, to fool the rest of us into thinking, you know, that this is a real
right.
Event.
And there are many Adamites. I mean, one example I could think of is Francis Parker Yockey.
Okay.
You know, there were many Adamites who were very dissatisfied with Nuremberg.
Right.
But it was a little too late.
Yeah, it was too late. Yeah. Yeah, and the whole thing was staged by communists and Zionists. Neither group could be considered impartial, okay? And virtually all of them Jews. And then they had a couple of front men, like the chief prosecutor, I forget what his name is, and a few others. But outside of the few Adamite front men, it was all Jews running the Nuremberg trials. Yes. Verse 11, and I punished them often in every synagogue and compelled them to blaspheme. And being exceedingly mad against them, I persecuted them even to foreign cities.
The cities outside, which
yes.
means Damascus is
okay.
what it means.
Well,
the cities outside Judea.
Okay. And in verse 12, whereupon as I went to Damascus with authority and commission from the chief priests, at midday, O king, I saw in the way a light from heaven above the brightness of the sun shining round about me and them which journeyed with me. And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking to me and saying in the Hebrew tongue, Saul, Saul, why persecute you me? It is hard for you to kick against the pricks. Okay,
the
kick, all
now this is a, you know, this reveals Paul's Greek learning.
Okay.
Because this was a common phrase from classical Greek which should probably be rendered, it is hard for you to offer vain resistance.
Yes, okay.
Okay, and it appears in Aeschylus, in Pindar, in Euripides, in Julian's orations. I mean, it's a common phrase.
Yeah, okay. So Agrippa...
And it does... Where it appears in verse in chapter 9, it's not in the Greek manuscripts, but here it is.
Okay. All right. Now, at this point, maybe you could discuss the two verses here, the one in 9 and the one here, showing that these aren't contradictory. That
there's nothing contradictory here, and it's that there's nobody that I know of raises a dispute with this account here.
Okay.
It's the dispute is only with the hearing of the voice and the mistranslation as the account is given in chapter 22, which we elucidated last week.
Okay. Okay. So basically, it's a translational problem, and of course, Paul is being accused of being duplicitous by giving two different accounts that don't agree with each other.
Right,
course,
but that was the translator's error.
Right, it's translator's
again. Basically, what Paul is saying in 22 is that they heard the voice, but they didn't understand what was being spoken.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, okay. So let me repeat verse 14 again. And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking to me and saying in the Hebrew tongue, Saul, Saul, why persecute you me? It is hard for you to kick against the pricks. And I said, who are you, Lord? And he said, I am Jesus, whom you persecute. But rise and stand upon your feet, for I have appeared to you for this purpose, to make you a minister and a witness both of these things which you have seen, and of those things in which I will appear to you, delivering you from the people and from the nations to whom now I send you, to open their eyes and to turn them from darkness to light, and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and inheritance, very important word here, and inheritance among them which are sanctified by faith that is in me. Please elaborate on verse 18 here.
Well, you know, every bit of this is indicative that Paul was preaching the gospel of the kingdom to the nations descended from Abraham.
Right.
Because he mentions our 12 tribes.
Yes.
You know, earlier in this chapter, he talks about our 12 tribes who had the hope of the promise that Yahweh made to our fathers.
That's right.
Paul is teaching the fulfillment of the old covenant in Christ and the new covenant being made with the children of Israel.
Right.
And anybody that accuses Paul of anything different is just an idiot that hasn't read the Bible.
Hasn't read it closely enough. Has just accepted the criticisms and the fallacious arguments of the Paul worshipers.
Absolutely. There's no doubt that they accept what the Catholic Church says on its face value or the evangelicals any one of those sects.
Yeah, and having read Eisenman and a few other Jews who virtually to a man say that Saul invented a new religion, okay, planting that false seed in the minds of Christians who read their rubbish, okay?
Absolutely. And,
he did
and
not
also,
start a new religion.
No, he's not. He's only showing the fulfillment of the Hebrew
right.
beliefs.
Yeah, and the disputes that he has with the traditionalist Judahites were all legitimate disputes, okay, that they wanted to maintain their old-fashioned rituals. And Paul is trying to say, hey, that stuff's been done away with. You don't have to do those rituals anymore.
As Daniel 9 tells us it would be, and other things in Scripture.
Right, right. The sacrifices and oblations shall cease, yes. And so he's fulfilling all of that. And he's explaining it to Israelites who don't get it. Okay? And that's Paul's mission. Now, once he's done, and of course, what's that verse that Paul says to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles, okay? Well, both of those are mistranslated, okay? It should be to the Judahites first and to the dispersed Israelites.
And that goes right hand in hand with Zechariah, who says that Yahweh will save the tents of Judah first.
Right, right.
There's no doubt. And that's why Paul went to Illyria. That's why he went to Illyria before he went to Asia.
Okay.
He had to go to the Dardanians in Illyria, who were the tribe of Judah.
Right.
Before he went to the Dorians in Asia, who were the tribe of Manasseh.
Yes, yes, very good. Okay, verse 19. Whereupon, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision, but showed first to them of Damascus and at Jerusalem and throughout all the coasts of Judea, and then, as we were just discussing, and then to the dispersed nations, that they should repent and turn to God and do works meet for repentance. Now, one of the points that I always bring up to people who believe in this Gentiles nonsense is that what Gentile, what non-Israelite, would even care or have any understanding of what Paul is talking about? What inheritance?
The word inheritance.
What Messiah? What are you talking about?
The word tribes. The whole, all the language shows that this is very specific.
Yes.
The promise having made by Yahweh. My translation of verse 6 here. And now for the hope of the promise having been made by Yahweh to our fathers.
Right.
Period.
Mm-hmm.
For which our 12 tribes. Period. Everything here that Paul is saying is exclusive. Just as we proved in Luke chapter 1. Just as we proved in Luke chapter 2. In Acts chapter 9 and 10,
yes.
This is all about the children of Israel.
There's
nobody
exclusive.
Else. And
right.
It's nothing but Israel on both sides of the cross. It's to the same people, period.
Right, right. It's just that the vast majority of Christians today don't understand that the dispersed Israelites of that time, they don't know anything about the dispersion.
They know nothing about history. The first Israel are the people Paul went to.
Exactly.
Paul went to nobody else.
And all the European white people, virtually every one of them, there were a lot of Japhethites as well, okay? And Paul makes a distinction between the Japhethites and the Israelites in his epistles, okay? He speaks to them differently because they are different.
Acts 17 is very clear.
Yeah, yeah.
Acts 17 is Paul's message to the Ionians, Javan.
Okay, yes.
Japhethites.
Mm-hmm.
We discussed that 3 weeks ago.
Right.
It's very clear.
So he even makes that distinction. We know in his other epistles, he excludes Edomites from the covenants. He excludes Ishmaelites from the covenants. So if he excludes those people, why would he go, you know, why would anybody think that he wants to go to the heart of darkest Africa and tell those black savages, your Messiah has come? Okay. What are you talking about, man? They would have no idea what he's talking about.
Right, there's no epistle of Paul to the Nigerians.
That's right. That's right. And so the lack of historical understanding of mainstream Judeo-Christianity is simply abysmal. Verse 21, for these causes the Jews caught me in the temple, and this time it's the correct word because it's the Edomite Jews who were after him, and went about to kill me. Having therefore obtained help of God, I continue to this day, witnessing both to small and great, saying no other things than those which the prophets and Moses did say should come. And I totally agree with you, Bill. He has not deviated one iota from what the law and the prophets and Moses had said would happen.
Absolutely.
It would be necessary. Verse 23, that Christ should suffer, and that he should be the first that should rise from the dead and should show light to the people and to the Gentiles and to the nations, of course. The dispersed nations of Israel is what we're talking about here.
Absolutely, and nobody else.
Right. Now, the question, I don't know if somebody, this question often comes up, the resurrection from the dead. Would this apply to non-Israelites?
Well, in the words of Yahshua Christ, he says that the men of Nineveh and the queen of the south, for instance,
yes,
would be in a resurrection.
Okay.
However, the men of Nineveh are of the Genesis 10 tribe of Asher.
Right.
They, not to be confused with the 12 tribe, you know,
right,
the Israelite Asher.
Right. The Assyrians.
Okay.
Yes.
The original Assyrians, and Jonah goes to them and speaks to both men and beasts, right?
Right.
And the word for man there is Adam. And there are still original Assyrians, not today.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if there's an original Assyrian today, he's somewhere in Central Europe.
Right, exactly.
And he's white.
Yes.
Because they were all white.
Yes.
Now, the original Assyrians were sons of Shem. Asher was a son of Shem.
Okay.
Okay? And they were white. They just weren't the chosen line.
Right.
But that doesn't make them any less white. That doesn't make them any less Adam. That doesn't mean they don't have the spirit. The first time that redemption is referred to in the Old Testament is long before the birth of Abraham in Genesis chapter 3.
Okay.
Lest
yes.
the man reach out and grasp the tree of life and
mm-hmm.
live forever. That's Genesis 3. I always forget the verse, 23
right.
or 20, towards the end.
Yes.
Basically, the queen of the south was from Sheba.
Right.
And there were two Shebas. There was a Hamitic Sheba and a Shemitic Sheba. And we don't know which ones
yes.
are the historical Sabians.
Right.
Because the Sabians are indeed historical. However, it really doesn't matter which one, because they were all originally white.
Right, whether of Ham or Shem, right, doesn't matter.
Right. And
yeah.
she was originally white, no
yes.
doubt.
No doubt, yeah. So the redemption applies to all of the white nations of Genesis 10, no doubt.
Well, the resurrection does, yes.
Right, the resurrection, sorry. Redemption applies only to Israel, yes.
Right.
And so Israel is an exclusive group within those nations of Genesis 10. It devolves upon us to fulfill these scriptures prophesied of us and not of the other whites of Genesis 10. Okay?
Well, that's what it really means when the promise is made to Abraham that through your seed, all of the families or clans
yes.
of the earth or the land, the Adamic land, would be blessed.
Right.
Those are the other Genesis 10 families
mm-hmm.
and nobody else.
Yes. Nobody else.
The other white branches of our race.
Yes. Okay. Verse 24. And as he thus spoke for himself, Festus said with a loud voice, Paul, you are beside yourself. Much learning does make you mad. But he said, I am not mad, most noble Festus, because speak forth the words of truth and soberness. For the king knows of these things, before whom also I speak freely, for I am persuaded that none of these things are hidden from him, for this thing was not done in a corner. So, in other words, Festus is having a hard time believing his religious beliefs.
Well, Paul is putting Agrippa on the spot.
Yeah.
Because Paul certainly knows he's an Edomite.
Right.
Okay, and he's, you know, all the Edomites profess to be Judah.
Right.
And this charade was going on from before Paul was born. Okay, and Paul is actually cornering Agrippa, and what we're going to see is Agrippa, like the typical Jew, very slyly gets out of the confrontation.
All right, yes, okay, so verse 27, King Agrippa, believe you the prophets? I know that you believe.
Now, this is a rhetorical question.
Right.
You do believe King Agrippa
yes.
and the prophets.
Don't.
I know.